Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We have with us here on the underline Kelvin Clark of AngleTech Cycles. Kelvin is widely revered in the recumbent industry for his encyclopedic knowledge and his cutting-edge products, as well as for the unprecedented quality of his work. So how are you doing today, Kelvin?
Good. We're still at it's 11 degrees in Woodland Park today.
11 degrees.
Up from 3 yesterday.
Oh, man. Is the sun shining?
Yeah. And the sun is shining. And
wow.
The sky is blue. And, we actually, yesterday we had 3 bike demos in 3-degree weather, which was pretty amazing. And we had guys here wearing face masks and gloves and lots of layers and riding recumbents out on the bike path.
Wow.
So okay. It was kind of a remarkable day. I was pretty surprised.
Okay, so now what we're going to do, we're going to come back and talk about Woodland Park in a second. But first of all,
sure. You
grew up in the bike business.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
Well, my father had a bike shop in Seattle that he started in 1954, and he sold Schwinn and Raleigh bikes along with Isetta, BMW Isetta, and Lambretta motor scooters. And so, he had a bike shop. He also did untraditional things. So he was always bringing in, things like that. And he had a bike shop in his basement when he was 18 years old, and he was involved as a road rep in the bike industry, wholesale-wise, before he opened his shop. And this shop is Angle Lake Cyclery in Seattle, and the shop still exists, and my brother Dale operates it. And so that's how the bicycle thing was in the blood, sort of thing, and that's how that happened. And so I worked in that shop every summer for... starting when I was probably about 12 or 13, we would go there on Saturdays and learned things that way. Built bikes in the back room, did warehouse work, worked with the public at the counter and all those types of things. And I did not have any idea, of course, at the time what it was going to lead to in the future. It was just something that I did, And so the biking thing... my dad Rex, he rode a single speed track hub bicycle from Tacoma, Washington to San Francisco, somewhere around 1939.
Oh my God!
And so real men don't need gears, right? So that's, and he kind of had that attitude. But he rode the Slumgullion Tour this last summer on a Ranzanetic crank forward bike, got to experience the need for gears and climbing mountain passes and things like that.
Wow.
So that's how it started out.
So which tour was that again?
Oh, the Slumgullion Tour. It's a tour that, it's a 4-day trip that is for AngleTech customers and it's usually all 100% recumbent. And it's done every summer, and I've done it for 13 years. So we have a variety of people who come. It's not, it's supposed to be a tour, not a race. There's always a couple people who like to put the hammer down for 4 days, but that's always like only a couple people. The rest of us are having a good time.
Wow.
It's a SAG tour. It's you get a hotel room every night. You get some cool, really neat food is happening. And we have a concert on the third night in Creed. With Joe U. Vegas, a local singer-songwriter who comes and plays, and usually another guy called Steve Hoke who comes as well. And so that's kind of one of our highlights of the year, is that situation. So anyway, this last year, my dad came out and rode the trip, and he always kept recalling his 1939 trip where he didn't even have a water bottle on his bicycle to ride to San Francisco. He just stopped off and got water along the way somehow. Out here you need to drink water. So
how old is your dad?
84.
84, and he's still powering, huh?
Yeah, so it was pretty cool.
Is he riding strong?
Well, he rode out of 263 miles. I think he rode 200 miles of that.
Oh my God!
And,
wow.
That's pretty cool.
On a Rans, huh?
Rans Zenetic, one of those crank forward bikes. Those new type of bikes that Randy's building. The idea of putting him on that bike was, since he didn't have recumbent experience, which is sort of the center of our universe, but I wanted him to be comfortable, that bike sort of gave him a familiar format that wasn't foreign, and at the same time he'd be comfortable, and which is what that bike delivered. So it was the right match for the situation.
Okay, now you chose Woodland Park, Colorado, when you and your brother kind of split the angle operation apart. Why didn't you stay in Seattle? Why didn't you just keep running yourself?
It was a vibe thing. Basically, I'd come here on a vacation in July in 1992, put 2,200 miles on a rental car in 9 days' time, doing day trips, and came back here twice. And it seemed like the right thing to do. So that's really what it was. It just felt like it was to be. So at that point in time, the recumbent business had become basically a full-fledged additional store inside the Seattle store. So I was spending all my time doing that. And at the time, we had three stores up there. And I really wasn't, I had my hands full just doing 100% recumbent customers. So the deal here was I moved the recumbent business here, and at that time it had become a national business, and transferred the toll-free phone number and found a 1,500 square foot building and hoped it would go. You know, hoped it would sustain itself without the other stuff. And it did, you know, and the building was here, and it was for sale, and so we bought the building, and ultimately the bike path in town that at the time was dirt across the street here, and that was pavement into the National Forest, but it eventually got paved into town, so the whole thing all came together, and it has worked out well.
Huh. Okay, so now your brother's up in Seattle with Angle Lake Cyclery out there by the airport.
By the airport, yeah.
He still sells recumbents.
Oh, he definitely does recumbents, but he also does Trek and Giant bicycles of the wedgie variety, and then he does recumbents as well, and Alex Moulton bikes from England. So he has a variety of bikes there, and he certainly is very much in the recumbent business, but it's not the only thing he does.
So he's got his niche, too, then, it sounds like.
Right, and Angle Tech is basically, you know, mostly 100% recumbent.
Huh, wow.
The exception being these other new bikes we just talked about.
Okay, Kelvin, you and I have talked a lot over the years, and I'm always greatly inspired by you. And I know that, like, I've gotten some fantastic bike accessories from you. Is it true that you research and study each and every product you carry?
That's the idea. I mean, if you, our list is not like everything on the market. It's basically select items in certain categories that have been checked out and researched. I still have a great time going to the Interbike show, checking things out, seeing what's there, and it's certainly something I love to do. And so we will pick a pedal in a category like the Bebop. We will pick the Tech Gas Strobe, where we'll pick out the other things. And the idea is that these are there for a reason. So when you look at the options and accessory list on the website, it's definitely an abridgment of what's on the market, but it's supposed to be the good stuff. The real thing, no filler. We have a section on the website called Not a Sausage, and it's on our T-shirts. When you get a T-shirt, when you from us, it'll say Not a Sausage on the back, and what it means is a real thing, no filler. So the thing with the accessories is that we try to find the real thing out there in a category, and we focus on it.
Okay, tell us about the Tech Ass.
The Tech Ass is kind of fun because it really came about because we were selling a strobe light from Specialized that we really liked a lot, but Specialized got out of the light business. And so we were looking around for a replacement rear strobe. And so at the time, there really wasn't anything exceptional out there. And so my brother had a customer come into his store on a trike that had this strobe that was extremely powerful. And then he disappeared for a few weeks. Apparently he'd rolled his trike or something like that. So he was gone, and we were thinking, well, how are we going to find out about this light? Well, he comes back in to the store, and I get a phone call from Seattle, and all I hear is two words with no introduction: tech apps. And I said, okay, so what does that mean? So it turned out that was the name of the light. And it comes from the rave dancing industry. Now, we're not rave dancers at AngleTech, but that's where the connection was. So we get the light from outside the industry. We have a mount that we use that comes from Germany, and we mount them up on the bikes, and the visibility of this thing is incredible.
It's phenomenal. Totally phenomenal light.
Pretty cool thing.
And it sells for, like, what, $35?
Yeah, $39.95 or something. Yeah.
And the batteries last forever as well.
Oh, yeah, LEDs never draw a lot of power. So it's a cool light, and lots of people have remarked about it in a good way.
Okay, now you make a mount for that. Is the mount something that can be
we
also
mounted?
We don't make a mount okay,
for it, Martin. It's basically a mirror mount we get from CycleStar, the mirror company we deal with out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it just allows this light, because it wasn't designed for the bike industry, to
right.
mount to bicycles. So we add that in the box with the light so that it can be used on a bicycle.
Huh. Now, you do have some kind of, the way I've shown you how I mount mine to my helmet, have you configured something for that as yet?
I don't have a dedicated helmet mount yet. No.
Okay. They're phenomenal lights, and they can be had at your website, angletechcycles.com.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Great. Okay. You've also got the best recumbent cable and lock, literally, that I've ever used. Tell us about that if you can.
Oh, it's the concept is a shackleless lock, which the cable itself is a cable that has it's not an aircraft cable like you see in most bike shops, which aircraft cables you can pretty much pick a bolt cutter length you want and snip the cable. And then shackled locks have an exposed vulnerability because they've got an exposed shackle. So the cable that we do is a braided cable, which means it's not cut proof, but it takes a lot of time to chew through it. So it takes a longer time to steal a bike that way. And the other piece is that at the end of the two cable ends fit into this shackleless lock. It's a round lock. And when you open it, it has just enough room to put the two cable ends in it and lock it up, which means there's no place for you to get a purchase on the shackle of the lock. So that's what it is. It's just good design. And it's a 7-foot cable, which is a little longer than usual, and it's not a self-coiling cable. It's a nice, supple, easy-to-wrap-up cable, so it's not going to torment your life while you're trying to pull it apart to lock your bike up around something. So those are the basics of it. It's a good setup.
So, for example, I lock my bikes up against telephone poles. No problem.
All right.
And within that, should I feel as safe locked that way as if it were with a U-lock, a kryptonite U-lock?
Technically, a U-lock in a lot of circumstances is stronger. However, there's been some issues about the tubular locks being more vulnerable to picking, and then U-locks can be frozen with Freon, and then they can be made to be brittle, and then you can hit them with a heavy hammer and they can shatter. So, you know, it's a hard thing to say exactly, but they're very, I would say yes, for the most part, to almost just as secure. It depends on how sophisticated the thief is and whether he knows all the tricks of how to bust up a U-lock.
Got it.
You're really just trying to hedge your bets a little bit, but it's a more reliable system than most out there. So.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit also about the niche you've carved there. Computers have these programs you can run that will optimize your hard drive, for example. You know, help them run at their peak efficiency. You become respected in the recumbent industry as an authority on what it takes to make recumbents perform at their highest possible level. So tell us about that.
Well, we do three things here. One is we sell recumbent bikes in the factory form, but that's not the main part of our business. The main part of our business is our specification packages that are used on other people's frames, like Rans or Easy Racer or Chetta or those companies. And what the idea is just stuff that I've learned over the years, and that means that we like things like sealed bearings, low maintenance things. We use a lot of fill wood bottom brackets and hubs, which are lifetime quality components. We like cold forged cranks, which are stronger than melt forged cranks, and things like that. So it's the idea here is to build a bike for somebody that they can lube the chain and air up the tires to the 100 pounds or more PSI and ride the bike and not be so tied up in the maintenance of the bicycle. And so that's the nature of what we do. I mean, the most popular spec to do is called ST27. That one is not the most expensive one we do. It's sort of in the middle, and people like it, and it's a good set. So, so just certain fundamentals that are part of what the way I think, and so when I spec a bike that way, it makes it a good situation. The third thing we do is we build our own stuff in certain ways. We do something called the Quadruped, which is a recumbent trike tadpole style that is arm and leg powered, and that one is a unique trike on the market, and that it's the only dual body trike marketed here these days. And it's a good setup. So we do have some wholly owned situations, but the main thing is high quality, long term componentry, not component of the month club stuff that's boutique oriented and fades away after 30 days. It's the long term good stuff.
Huh? Kind of like the Suntour componentry, I guess. Huh?
I mean, well, we use the Suntour crank because we can use that with a wood bottom bracket and get you a lifetime crank bearing on a crank system, and it weighs less than the quote new technology Shimano Ultegra Hollow Tech stuff. So it actually weighs less, even though it is technically on paper it's been hyped as being the old technology. So we do think about these things.
Okay, now Kelvin, when you receive a bike in a box from a manufacturer, do you there's a lot to be said for how the bike is assembled and put together for the consumer. Speak to that just for a bit. How important, how much of a focus you place on that part of the actual completion of getting the bike to the customer stuff.
Well, the bike, if it were one of our own specs, would come in as a frame set to start with. We would hand-build the wheels here. Hand-built wheels still outlast robotic wheels as far as long-term durability. We do the usual facing and chasing of threads on the frame, that kind of stuff. We do a complete out of the bicycle. We take measurements. There's a measurement chart on our website that we use. So we pre-size the bike, and then the bike is road tested live with real people on streets. So we do that, and then the bike is, if it's being shipped, then it will be then repackaged with a short list, about a half a dozen items long, of what to do when you see your bicycle arrive by UPS. And but at that point, the cables are all pre-adjusted and everything like that. So it's not a mechanically degreed requirement once you get a bike. And so you basically are mounting the wheels, inserting handlebars, and seat. And and depending on how sophisticated the option list is, there may be some extra work to do. But that's what we try to do.
Okay, now do you ever find yourself like I know Shaw's Lightweight Cycles in Santa Clara used to build for Specialized. He built their bikes that would go off to magazines for demo, and he'd actually lay the frames on a table to make sure they were straight, and he just totally was like meticulous and fastidious in how he remanufactured, I shouldn't say, reassembled the machines. Do you take it to that level?
Well, we don't have an alignment table like that. We have dropout alignment tools and things like that that we check things out with, and frequently derailleur hangers are not aligned right, and that's something that can be done and easily done. The vendors that we get frames from tend to build bikes in a good, you know, well aligned way. So as far as with recumbents, as far as having a granite alignment table like you would find in a wedgie frame builder's place, for the variety of stuff that comes through, that's more difficult to do. But we do check out the basics like that and make sure the threads are right, making sure the derailleur alignment's right, the dropout spacing is correct for the axles and things like that.
Okay, now you used to do a lot of work with Rands and a lot of work a lot of work with Bill Hluzak at Hluzak Cycles, and kind of taking certain models and moving them to a whole different level of performance capacity. Can you talk about what you've done for, like, Bill's bikes, for example?
Well, on Bill Hluzak's bike, we just had a customer with an original Hluzak Horizon that he had owned and had some experience with up here in Boulder, Colorado, and it was simply, he had stuff he didn't like about it that were not earth-shattering things, but things that he wanted to optimize. So what he wanted was the ultimate Hluzak. So it was the customer's initiated the process, and what he wanted to do squared with our thinking here, and so the frame that is on our website on that bike there was the idea of moving the wheelbase forward a little bit, moving the seat mount back a little bit, getting the weight distribution to where it was more, it was biased a little to the rear as opposed to a little to the front, which took away the light feeling rear wheel, shortened the boom because which reduced pedal steer. The tubing was 2-inch diameter, which was more rigid. The rear end was triangulated, and Hluzak was all receptive to doing this. It was like catching them at the right time as well. It was the winter when we did this. In fact, the first picture we took of the bike was in a snowstorm. The guy picked it up. We had to photograph it in the snow originally. But that's what it was. And so it took the inspiration of someone asking about it and then the thinking of what to do here. And that was based on other bikes that had been experienced that had better manners than that original bike. So it produced a better Hluzak. So it still had all the elements of that, and Hluzak certainly was very much a part of it because they, Bill Hluzak followed the thread of the conversation and agreed to make the changes and built the frames. And that's how we got started with that. And that frame set is available from us on a bike we build, and it's available through Bill Hluzak as well.
Wow. Okay.
So that's how that kind of thing happens. So it's fairly, low profile stuff.
But so if someone had like an existing anything, they could come to you and say, Kelvin, can you optimize this bike?
Yes, but I would also say that it's in most cases it has to do with componentry in our case, because most of the time we're dealing with a fundamentally good design. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, if there's something like in this case, it was the original Hluzak had been around a few years, and so making this little change sort of brought it into what I considered more modern short wheelbase design based on what some other companies had been doing in the meantime. Mm-hmm. Okay? And these were things that made sense to me, and I had also experienced, like the Slumgullion Tour that we talked about at the beginning of this conversation. That's a fun ride, and it's a great break in the year to go out and hang out with 30 very, exceptional people on recumbents, but it also doesn't, it also can't be escaped that it becomes an R&D ride of whatever happens to be ridden that year. It's a great place 4 days in the mountains, I mean, you're going to find out if a bike has bumps there. You're going to find out if it goes up a hill good. You're going to find out if it's good down a hill at, you know, down a mountain pass at 42 miles an hour or something like that. So these little events kind of come back and register in your mind, and then if something comes up, that's it. But it's not our business to go complete, you know, a big part of what happens here is to go back to manufacturers and have them build one-offs or designs as a part of regular daily thought, because there's a lot of good design out there, you know. So the people that we work with build good stuff. So I wouldn't put capital letters on this particular idea. It's something that happens from time to time when the time and season is right, but it's not the center of our universe.
Got it. Okay. Well, adjacent to that, though, I think it's such that AngleTech Cycles in Woodland Park, Colorado, leaves no stone unturned, literally, you know. You know, even something as simple as tires, you know, you've studied them, you know, there's very little printed matter out there, so someone can reach your level of knowledge. Where did you get all of your info about tires and tubes, and for that matter, the wheels themselves?
It's just time, I suppose. I mean, the tire thing, one of the tire things was an education when back in Seattle, Alex Moulton, who's an English engineer who is well known for making sophisticated space frame full suspension ride bicycles, and we did a lot of his bikes in the 80s, in the early 80s, and he would come over from England once a year and hang out for a few days. And his father, his grandfather, licensed the patent for vulcanizing rubber to Charles Goodyear, in the United States.
Wow.
And he had something to do with the Avon Rubber Company, which is still on the planet as building tires for automobiles, I believe. And so this guy knew a lot about rubber. So if you just take a piece of the Alex Moulton experience, we would have dinner, my brother and I, with Alex, and we would learn things every year. So it was like having sitting around the table with a professor of something and learning things. So this is all just accumulated knowledge over meeting people who know what they're talking about. And in this case, Alex taught us about rubber. So we learned about high latex compound rubber, high carbon compound rubber, etc. And so learning about rubber, and nowadays that knowledge still comes back 20 years later. Somebody like Schwalbe or Vredestein or you know, Richie can talk about certain things on a piece of paper about their tires, and I can relate to it because I remember these conversations, and so I can take that knowledge and apply it. Okay. So it's those types of things. It's also, I mean, you go back to tubing, you know, and that sort of thing, or frame material. You can look, I mean, I remember a 1979 or so Trek catalog, and that was the first time I had seen a yield strength chart, and it showed you different materials, chrome moly, aluminum that was welded, bonded aluminum. It was probably the middle 80s, now that I think about it. But anyway, and high tensile steel. And it showed you on a chart how much yield strength is how much you can bend a tube and have it still come back to its original shape. Okay? So, and now there's, of course, titanium and things like that. So when a yield strength figure comes up, I mean, it's a measure of durability for bicycle tubing. And that's been helpful. So that chart is still in my world.
Wow.
So these are things you need to learn from people in life. So I think everybody in every world has these experiences. This is not just one person's world, you know.
Well,
and that's how these things get applied. And so they affect how the bikes come out of here or what kind of stuff ends up in our organization. And but other people in other worlds have those experiences as well.
Well, you talk about other worlds, Kelvin, like this type of thing just comes to people and they are able to kind of understand that this is something they should pay attention to. You paid attention. That's the key. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's fun and interesting, and that's the main thing. And this whole world has never gotten stale to me, so it's still fun, still interesting, and that's what makes things move ahead.
Have you ever thought about selling your seal of approval? You know, like a good housekeeping does.
No.
Wow. Man, well, you know, there's other ways you've taken the art of the bike shop to a whole new level. Tell us about the dream bikes you make.
Well, there's always the alternative if somebody doesn't like what they see from a manufacturer spec or from our packages and wants to do something special, then we will do that. We work with a custom painter here in Colorado Springs, Spectrum. If somebody has a taste for a certain mix of componentry, part of the process of getting a bike from Engeltech involves one of two things. If you come here physically to Woodland Park, Colorado, then you do something called Recumbent 101, which is a minimum two-hour visit here. And we do have people who fly in from other states and come and do it and go home, as well as people who drive in and do it that way. And that familiarizes you with the formats of bikes. Position relative to your hips, handlebar formats, wheel size stuff, all those dynamics become real to people that way. The other way it's done is by phone consult, which involves basically a 45-minute conversation on our toll-free number, 800-793-3038, and that involves basically an in-depth interview of the individual. Okay, so that identifies the format of what needs to happen, and then if somebody wants to do the dream bike deal, I mean, that's a byproduct of that initial conversation. Either something that is already on paper works, or something like that with changes works, or somebody like, for example, if you look at the current website and you look at there's a blue Fold Rush on there in the long wheelbase section, and it's a bike that's up in Alberta, Canada. And that gentleman wanted this ideal commuting bicycle. So if you go look at the pictures, you'll see, you know, there is a zipper fairing on there. There are these wood fenders that come to us from Sykes, and we do and you'll see a lighting system that comes from Monterey, California, and you'll see all kinds of cool stuff on there. A rotor crankset, which comes from Spain through Colorado to us here. And that's a very cool bike. Now, that's an example of somebody's dream, okay? And that's probably the most clear-cut way to show that example would be to go look at that bicycle on pictures. And it's a very attractive bike. But the artist of the painting was as much the customer on the other end of the telephone as it was us here. So it's always fun when you put those together and you see the result comes out so cool looking.
Wow.
And so the customer participates and we end up with something special.
Well, okay, we're kind of getting to the point where in this interview where we've got to start wrapping things up. You've been in the recumbent industry a long time.
Since
79. Jeez.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot of manufacturers come and go. You've seen the big guys try to get involved, Trek and some of these other folks. Will Bents ever get into the mainstream?
I think more and more, yes. I mean, the example that's always, you know, shown is in 79. The mountain bike was invented in 78. Americans, the Avatar 2000 from Boston is what we involved ourselves with in 1979. So the recumbent and the mountain bike showed up on the scene at the same time. The mountain bike exploded and became a very big deal. The recumbent barely showed up. Now, in the late 90s, the recumbent... Anyway, it's getting incrementally more and more popular. The issue is, I think, is the companies mostly involved do not have deep pockets. It isn't like somebody that's going to... Somebody like a Trek was simply... Recumbents were not part of their culture enough to develop something exceptional in a recumbent line. So not always is the powerful company going to be able to execute. So is it going to become mainstream? I think it's going to become a more and more significant part of bicycles as the good old baby boomers get older and want not to accept discomfort as part of bike riding. And it's really a word-of-mouth thing, and it's an incremental thing, and whether it's going to be the dominant road bike of the planet, I would say probably not. I think tradition still carries a lot of weight, and it takes a lot of time to chink away at that. But I don't have anybody who buys a recumbent who wishes they didn't. And people generally find they ride their recumbent three times the mileage per year over their previous wedgie self. And that has to have a cumulative effect.
Wow. Can you tell us, hit that number one more time?
Well, this is anecdotal from people that I've dealt with over the years. But the feedback is they ride their recumbent bike three times more mileage than their past wedgie bike self.
Wow.
Per year. And that's because when you ride a recumbent, you don't have any morning after pains and things like that. So the frequency goes up because when you look at it in the garage, it's not a threat. Okay, so you'll tend to go on a bike ride more often than go to the movies or something. And then the other piece of it is, if you're out on a ride, you're not compelled to turn around as soon, so you tend to do longer rides. So it just tends to be you become more of a cyclist, and you tend to find more reasons to use your bicycle. And in most people's cases, that's the figure that comes back. I mean, it's not inconsistent. It's very consistent from people from all backgrounds.
And is that all ages as well?
Yes, all ages, although there's fewer young people. But I'm finding now that the demographic is starting to drop in age. Most of the time, it was people in their 40s to 60s, and now I would have to tell you that I do have people in their late 20s and early 30s starting to look at recumbents. So that's a good sign.
Great. Excellent. Well, is there anything that I missed that you'd like to kind of address here or speak to or flesh out or something like that?
I think we've covered some good ground, Martin.
All right. Well, as I said earlier, we've had some great conversations over the years. You know, it's always been a treat to talk to you, and I always learn so much. Literally, it's like I sit at the knees of a master when I get on the phone with you. And I hope that you other people can kind of have some measure of access to that incredible body of knowledge that you've got in your mind. So thanks, Kelvin.
Okay, Martin.
You're awesome. Totally awesome guy. You really are. That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.